and how our Zen practice affects our response to it. I bring it up with some trepidation. It's sort of like bringing up religion and politics at a family gathering. Actually, it might be more like talking about mortality at the bedside of a very sick loved one. I guess part of that is because many of you, some of you I've known for years, and I don't know where you are with this, because we don't talk about it. We haven't talked about it. And it feels to me like to not talk about it is to maintain the fiction that things are just going to continue on as they are continuing on now, which is kind of like living in la-la land, because clearly that's not the case. So for me, there's a relief that comes when someone else notices that, why, yes, there really does seem to be an elephant in the room, and you're not just crazy. I'm saying that we face a very difficult time of great suffering, and we need to have this conversation to help each other face whatever it is that we may face. I guess I've been an apocalyptic since the 50s, when the U.S. and Soviet governments engaged in a nuclear arms race, threatening each other with nuclear weapons, even after seeing the horror and devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Looking back now, that danger seems kind of simplistic compared to our present situation. In a nuclear exchange, the end would be sudden, or at least, you know, with a time frame of days or weeks. And it would be horrific for most of us. But now the dangers are multiple and unpredictable. In 1960, I began to take part in political activism to end war and militarism. I was new to Zen practice at that time, sitting with a little group of people around Suzuki Roshi in Japantown in San Francisco. I was influenced to activism by my study of Buddhism, Gandhi, and a feeling of commitment to the many beings destroyed in war. A Buddhist response to war was expressed in a literary magazine at the time called A Journal for the Protection of All Beings, a title referring to our Bodhisattva vow. And this journal carried the writings of some of my favorite poets, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, Michael McClure. Many of these young people were friends of Joko's. 50 years later, after its publication, nuclear war is still a danger. A nuclear explosion anywhere today would trigger terror and very likely retaliation. But now there are other dangers that may be less sudden, but will be just as deadly. Among them are deforestation, water shortage, soil depletion, and all the effects of climate change, chaotic weather, species extinction, rising sea level, glaciers melting, pollution of virtually everything by plastics and industrial chemicals. In the 50 years since that time, human population has more than doubled, from about 3 billion to about 7 billion. This population overshoot makes it almost certain that our children and grandchildren will live in a time of famine, disease, and a vast human die-off. For many species, the apocalypse is now. How do we talk to the children about this? How can we not talk to them about this? I have to believe they know. The information is all there, even if it's mostly submerged in the mainstream media by sports, political charades, and celebrity scandal. a media which is more like a marketing arm of the empire than a presentation of real events. Still, there's the internet, and the children must see the images of masked police with military weaponry lined against the desperation of the hungry and oppressed. The children must know in their bones that the changes they see happening around them are happening all over. An indication that they know is the phenomenal popularity of the Hunger Games novels. Finally, through fantasy, someone is getting real. So here we stand, still, well-fed, well-dressed, on the upper deck of the Titanic, watching as we approach the iceberg, gradually beginning to get our minds around it. As we do that, we'll have various responses. Some will jump overboard. Others will look for lifeboats. Others will go back to the back deck, which will go down last. This is a critical juncture in our social and ecological evolution. Indeed, it's not even a juncture, for there's no question of reversing or turning aside. The impact has already begun. That's the bad news. Some decades ago, Gary Snyder wrote a gentle, even sweet little poem about apocalypse called For the Children. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us, the steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. In the next century or the one after that, they say, are valleys, pastures. We can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together. Learn the flowers. Go light. There's never been a more important time in history to bring the resources of Buddhism to bear on behalf of all beings. The threats and disasters we face ultimately stem from the human mind and therefore require deep changes within our minds. This is something that we as Buddhists have some facility with. As personal suffering stems from craving and ignorance, from the three poisons of greed, ill will, and delusion, the same applies to the suffering that we experience on a collective scale. Our ecological emergency is a larger version of our daily and perennial personal emergencies. We have something to offer in this regard. That is the self-reflective inquiry of Zazen and the precepts, and an understanding of impermanence and interconnectedness. Buddhism holds that the universe and all creatures in it are intrinsically in a state of complete wisdom, love, and compassion, acting in natural response and mutual interdependence. Call it Buddha nature. In the Song of Awakening that we chanted in service this morning, there is the line that even our ignorance is the Buddha nature itself. The personal realization of this original nature cannot be had by, for, and by oneself, because to cling to the self is to cling to the illusion of separateness and to the fear and suffering that comes from feeling disconnected not only from other people, but from the earth itself. In a Buddhist view, that which obstructs the effortless manifestation of this is ignorance, leading to fear and craving. We understand now that ignorance, fear, and craving are caused and encouraged not only by personal clinging to the illusion of a separate self, but by powerful social and political forces determined to maintain a system of inequality and privilege. Contemporary governments, economic entities, and social orders maintain their existence by deliberately fostering craving and fear. Mass marketing promotes the stimulation of greed, which cannot be fulfilled, even though the earth itself is consumed in the attempt. Sexual desire, which cannot be satiated, and hatred, which has no outlet except against oneself and a world made inanimate by commercial commodification. The deliberate fostering of fear through tribalism, violence, and conflict makes it easier to manipulate people into ignorance and passivity. We have something important to offer here. In this situation, the joyous voluntary poverty of the old Chinese monks offers us the grace of necessity as we return to older ways of livelihood. Non-harmfulness offers us a way to maintain integrity in the face of conflict. Interdependence offers us the realization of our power to change the world by changing our minds. The doctrine of no self is a gateway to courage and a remedy for paralyzing fear. Altogether, we offer a way of mental decolonization and a restoration of our place in the natural world. That's the good news. I'd like to go more into Gary Snyder's poetic prescription for us and for the children, because it's the kind of response that generates benefit, whatever the outcome may be. It's resonant with Buddhist ethics. It's practical. And all of us in this Sangha are already working on it in our own way. That's the good news. Stay together, he says. Build strong, resilient communities. Nurture networks of love and trust. Live together, work together, love each other, take care of each other, not in a narrow tribal way, but in a way that respects the personhood and dignity of all beings. We can do this. We have made companion animals beloved parts of our families. We can extend that sense of family and community much more widely to include the grasses, trees, stones, and the soil that sustains us. People who do best at basic survival tests, they say, are cooperative team players, often altruistic and mindful of the common good. In disasters like hurricanes or earthquakes, people surprise us by their sacrifice. Food, shelter, even sometimes of their life itself. Those who survive social and economic collapse, wars, pandemics, or famine are likely to be those who manage scarce resources fairly. Hoarders and bullies may sometimes win in the short run only to end up dead, exiled, or friendless. So in every way we can, we need to help each other and our children learn to be cooperative rather than competitive, to be helpful rather than hurtful, to look out for the communities of which we are a part and on which we ultimately and utterly depend. This is not only helpful in getting through tough times, but is so much more graceful and comforting than the alternative. Learn the flowers, Gary says. This means to notice your surroundings and learn about them. Our Stone Age ancestors knew hundreds of plants intimately, knew their benefits as food, beauty, or medicine, knew the stages of their lives, their affinities and relationships. I imagine the coastal Indians traveling to the Sierras each summer on the same trails, walking by the same trees, meadows, and rocks year after year, seeing their changes over a lifetime, and coming to consider them beloved friends. I believe we all want this and are each working on it in our own way. We've been companions with them throughout our evolutionary journey together, and there is surely within our DNA a template for restoring a relationship with them based on reciprocity and respect. Plants have the incredible ability to metabolize the energy of sunshine and generously make it available to us as food. Many of them base their life strategy on that generosity and become irresistibly beautiful as well as delicious. Amazing. How did we get so lucky? It's only polite that we would learn their names, study their stories, nurture them and defend them from danger as best we can. Go light, he says. Go light means to live carefully, considering the implication of our lives and actions, doing our best to apply the precepts to our everyday life. If we do this diligently, we can lighten human impact upon the planet. The first precept, to refrain from killing, for instance, means to cultivate reverence for life, to treasure it and encourage it. I cringe at the word antibiotic, because aren't we all biotic? The second, to not take what is not given, includes not hoarding, not taking more than our share. It also includes helping others to keep their dignity and autonomy as well as their life. The third precept, to be responsible with our sexuality, means that we lighten up with each other, that we are careful, and that we avoid dramas that generate pain, suffering, and that we cultivate bonds of pleasure and happiness. The fourth precept, to be truthful, means that we look as deeply as we can into life as it is, into the pain of life as well as into the pleasure. Sometimes people don't want to hear these things, saying that to dwell on the negative is to give it energy and thereby to create the very outcome we want to avoid. If you're one who feels that way, please forgive me. There may be some circumstances where that's what happens, but I don't think it works that way with addiction, for instance, and I don't think it works that way with navigating around icebergs, and I don't think it's helpful in facing economic or environmental catastrophe. In order to build communities of trust, we have to be trustworthy. To be trustworthy, we must be truthful with ourselves and expect truthfulness from others. Does that sound quaint? I'm afraid it does, but this is our project, however short of it we fall. Buddhism will be changed by all this, and all this will be changed by Buddhism. So, once more, for the children. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us. The steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. In the next century, he wrote this in the previous century, actually. In the next century or the one beyond that, they say, our valleys, pastures, we can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together. Learn the flowers. Go light. Thanks for hearing me out with this. And not such a feel-good talk, but not without its good news.
It's proper for Memorial Day.
Excuse me?
It's proper for Memorial Day.
I guess so, yes. Yeah. So where are you with this?
I've been with this since the late 60s, reading Gary Snyder and wishing somehow, even though I was part of different communities, I always felt that we were somehow not addressing, you know, really deeper issues. But then I would think, well, how can we?
Yeah.
But just recently, I was thinking about the possibility. I've been going to a lot of different centers, Buddhist gathering places lately, because Jisho's not here. And I was just wondering, you know, is there a possibility that Buddhists, as such, will at some point join together? You know, all our little nice little groups here and there. I mean, but I have apocalyptic fears and visions all the time, and I always have. So I've had to kind of learn to, you know, see them coming and not totally freak out. And, but I'm glad you're talking about it, because I feel like, yes, people don't want to talk about it. You know, keep hoping that... I remember at one point I just was thinking to myself, just don't make it hurt too hard, you know. But... We keep hoping that we can just get by a little bit longer before it all falls apart.
Right.
Which is not the...
I visited my grandchildren in Australia a year ago and realized at some point that I did not know what to say to them. Mm-hmm. I didn't know... how to talk to them. Their parents talk to them as if, you know, their life would be normal. They would, you know, be teenagers and go to college and get a job and have families of their own, as if, you know, as if this wasn't happening around them. It just, you know, hurt my throat trying to think about it. And so this is for me, it's not just for you.
A couple things. I'll try not to drag us out because it's not my place to do that. Well, there's the old story about the guy who's running from something or other and falls off a cliff and grabs a root and he's dangling there and looks down and there's a tiger down there and he realizes he can't hold on to the root forever, and then right there's a strawberry, you know the story, right? It's a strawberry, it's the best strawberry he ever ate, you know, and there's that, so that sense of trying to stay present in the moment even when it's disaster in all directions, you know, and that it makes it more peaceful. So that, I think, is going on. And the other thing for me is that there's been this weird little dance back and forth between Japan and us since the 40s, you know, because it was our country that developed the technology and we dropped it on them, and Buddhism came this direction, and of course it was sloshing back and forth of those things. And the weird truth is that the same technology that we developed, mostly, we weren't the only developers because there were others, but it's the same technology that shows us that it verifies the Buddhist precept or concept that this is all just a dream anyway, that there is no material reality actually, it's just stuff vibrating, and if you try to find the thingness of it, you really can't do that. And now, of course, to put even a little sharper point on that, the Fukushima reactor failure right a year ago last March, which they still haven't solved, and it gets worse all the time. And 1,500 and 65, I think, is the number of cesium rods in the roof of reactor number 4 that could just go down and out at all times. And they've found little bulges in the wall just this last week. And everybody's freaking out because if that goes down, then everything goes down. Globally, really. I mean, worst case scenario. So we're hanging by the roof. You know, everybody is, right? And there's that kind of weaving back and forth between our technology and now this is happening in Japan, and it's kind of, it's been on my mind in the sense of how we, whether we take form to be emptiness and emptiness also to be form in this, in the potential apocalyptic scenario you're talking about. It's just very interesting to see which strawberry, whether we deal with the strawberry or the tiger down below, and you know, we're always going to be dealing with both. How to play that, you know, day to day, like you said, kids and coworkers and so forth.
Well, some of the people on the Titanic were very good at making beautiful music, and they did that. And that, you know, I resonate to that choice. Yes.
You know, like in his poem, he says, from those last three lines, he says, stay together. And, you know, I realize everything you say is true. But you feel a little bit like we're sort of preaching to the choir here, and even in Sonoma County. And so how do you get out there? Well, there's a certain feeling of helplessness there.
Yeah.
And so you do what you can, whatever it is. But, like, my daughter is due in August with her first grandchild, and it's like you can only do so much, you know. And then when you say stay together, it's like, what, am I not going to be joyful that she's having this child? It's sometimes you have to turn in and look at what's important rather than just, you know, shaking your hands about everything.
I know, exactly. Oh, wait.
I really resonate with how to speak to your grandchildren. I have a number of, and I think about that too. What else I want to say is that I really appreciate you talking about the precepts, with the precepts class coming up and precepts renewal ceremony coming up, and reminding us that it's not about us. I mean, that the precepts aren't just personal. They're, you know, they extend out, and without that extension out, they're only half fulfilled. So
yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that it's so hard to talk about is that, and I would love to be able to have these conversations with more people, but there's always the argument that, well, with new technology, we come up with new ways to solve it and extend oil, and you know, and it has been happening. You know, the root, we've been holding on to the root for a really long time, and we don't seem to, you know, we're still in suspension, and so it's really hard to talk to the people who really are in the illusion, and it's kind of easy to be drawn into the illusion and, you know, constantly weaving back and forth.
Right, especially if there are people that you love and you don't want to, you know. You don't want to tell them, hey, look, you're really sick and you're not going to make it. Okay.
Well, I'm just jumping on to the rest of the train. A dear friend of mine who recently died used to always go to a yearly conference called the Bioneers.
Yes.
And she said that one year they printed out a list of all the different scientific and groundswell groups that were addressing climate change and all, what else do you call it, ecology, and it was like 4 pages, and then the next year the printer was going for like 2 weeks before it was done printing. And I have actually taken hope in information like that, because I believe that like Suzuki Roshi said, there's little mind and big mind, and we are only ever so fortunate to catch glimpses of big mind, certainly has nothing to do with me as an ego, but that there is something, and I think if we can trust it, it's a little hard to trust, but it's the bottom line kind of trust that it's somehow, you know, the problem is way bigger than us, and so is the solution. And so that's why it makes sense to say, stay close together, learn to grow food, learn what the herbs are, because there is something happening. I mean, there are these kids out there that are doing incredible things.
And especially in right here in the Sevastopol area.
And especially in other countries all over the world. And there's this other thing, you know. I remember when I was still an active addict, I used to wonder if there was two trains running, and one of them was the addiction and one of them was the desire for recovery. And I kept wondering if which train was going to come in first. And I actually lucked out on that one. And I sort of feel the way about the world. But, you know, it's never been up to us. But we can do... I don't know. They say, you know, 100 people practicing peace in a huge metropolitan area can lower the crime rate. Why not anything else? I don't know. I get really scared, and then I remind myself, I don't know.
Right.
But it's too bad that more people aren't out there saying, hey!
Santa.
I don't know. It's the children part. I don't have grandchildren yet, you know.
Yeah.
But just thinking about my kids, and they're pretty much thriving, and they're thriving in existing paradigms, you know. Like my son is a sports fanatic, but it's his religion, especially baseball. And for him, it's not just it's the game, but it's the team, you know. So he, you know, it's about how we come together. And I don't think it's as much about that as it is even competition, you know. But there's something very much, he has a heart connection to it. He always has from the time he was 3. And my daughter's going on, just graduated from college and going on to get a PhD in business and behavioral marketing and things like that.
She just graduated.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah. And you know what? I don't want to be the one to say, did you know that...
The world's coming to an end.
Coming to an end in your lifetime, or your
yes.
What are you going to do about it, you know?
Yes.
I won't be here, you know? And, I mean, I have my own bubble of denial and apathy and things like that, and I really don't want to tell them that. I don't have the power to kill their spirit, you know, but even saying something like that, because they wouldn't believe it or choose to believe it, because they're very I think they're very optimistic kids generally, or young adults. So I wouldn't want to kill that spirit, even though, you know, you should be doing something with ecology, or you should be doing, you know, something, not sports. It's like they're living their life, and they believe in, they have to believe in something. They have to believe in the government or something, or the possibility of fairness or democracy, or what, you know, it's like whatever, they have to believe that it's going to be okay on some level, it feels to me.
Yeah.
But there is the counterbalance to that. One of the poets you mentioned,
reality.
Michael McClure, who's very, very knowledgeable about science, always has been, said to me on the phone the other day, it'll all be over for humanity by the end of this century.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we also have to live with that, too. without it defeating our spirit.
Exactly, right. It goes back to Wendell Berry's advice that I quoted him a few weeks ago about live a joyful life even though you know the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's the question. How do we be real about this? We have to be real. I don't think we can maintain a fiction with each other. I don't want to maintain a fiction with each other because that undermines trust and friendship and intimacy and everything. So, and yet, it's on the one hand and it's on the other hand. Fortunately, another thing that is one of our special offerings is a tolerance for ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And here we are in the question. And I don't know, is there anything else anyone would like to... Eric.
It's a damn good strawberry and a damn fearsome tiger.
Yes.
And isn't yes. there a possibility that we could just go back into a dark age?
We could. That is there's ambiguity. Well,
yeah.
Talking about this expanding efforts of non-governmental organizations and social movements and everything, one of the biggest ones, and it has not quite been recognized publicly yet, is the movement for food sovereignty. And it includes everything from the permaculture movement, of which Sonoma County is a real hotbed. And it includes the organic food movement. It includes the movement to label genetically modified organisms.
And have your own seeds.
Yes, seed savers. Seed savers.
The slow food movement.
The slow food movement. Yes, indeed. All that is...
that seed bank in Petaluma.
It's big.
That big old
yes, indeed.
Seed bank.
Yes. and the people involved in this include many young people who are at the peak of their determination and energy. So, whatever happens, let's do it in beauty. Yeah. And grace to the best that we can.